Not hold that against her. She worked for the Baltimore News American. She was a freelance reporter for the Washington Post, and she was a reporter for the Fort Worth Star Telegram, covering everything from cops and courts to the Branch Davidian siege of Waco, which I'd really like to hear about. Her first book was Jewish Stars in Texas, and some of the work that she did, I relied on, you know, in Jewish Confederates. Went into three printings and is available in paperback. Her second book, Jewish Junior League, The Rise and Demise of the Fort Worth Council of Jewish Women, traces the growth and collapse of Fort Worth's century-old section of the National Council of Jewish Women. Actually, she said that the National Junior League threatened to sue her for trademark infringement over the suit of its name in the book title, but I'm sure she got a good lawyer and got out of that. But anyway, Hollis was the editor of Lone Stars of David, the Jews of Texas, a coffee table book from Brandeis University Press. The book cover pictures a custom-made pair of cowboy boots with gold Jewish stars. After she wrote the centennial history of her Reform congregation, Fort Worth's oldest country club, she wrote the history of Fort Worth's oldest country club. And this book has been in the works for some time. Is this the 500-page, 10-pound book, which is coming out any day now? So she's written a lot. One of my favorite articles that she wrote is, you'll like this, Whistling Dixie While Humming HaTikva. Gets the award for the best title. Published in the winter 2007 issue of American Jewish History, which of course is the leading journal academic history. She's past president of the Southern Jewish Historical Society, past president of her sisterhood, Fort Worth. She lives with her husband. She comes from a military family. Her husband Bruce is a pediatric dentist, but he went to VMI and served his country in the Army, Air Force?
Air Force.
Air Force. And your son is?
In the Air Force.
In the Air Force. Her daughter, formerly a producer of the Fox Radio News Network, lives in New York, producing a set of 40 videos for YouTube. And her son is an Air Force officer. She and her husband have three grandchildren. I like this part. She keeps her sanity and stays in shape by working out with Team Richmond, a master swim team, and bicycling on the Trinity River Trail. I don't know. So would y'all help me welcome Hollis Warner.
Thank you. Hi, well, it's great to be back in South Carolina. I want to thank Robert, my fellow traveler. We've run around together in Austin and in Newport. When he came to Austin to speak to the Texas Jewish Historical Society, we wanted to sell his books, and none of the books, only one bookstore in Austin had a copy of his book. So we found the book and we auctioned it off. And you know how Texans are. It sold for $1,000. Yes, we had a good time in Austin. So it's good to be here today to see him. And I want to thank Marty and Enid for arranging a lot of the details of my visit. It's also nice to come back after many years and see that they are still running the show here. You have a lot of continuity in Charleston, among the Charleston Jewish community, and I want to thank them both for facilitating these today. And it's good to see my friends Adam Mendelson and Les Bergen and Jane, from my friends from the Southern Jewish Historical Society. And last but not least, Dale Rosengarten. When Dale contacted me to come here today, I was really surprised. I thought, why do you want me to come here? Me? You want to hear all about Texas? She said, no. I want you to talk about Jews. About Jews in politics. Oh, well, you know, I'm really interested in Jews in politics, but I haven't addressed that before. There's a lot of books about this politician and that politician. And so she gave me quite a challenge. Get to work finding out about Southern Jews in politics. So to begin with, how do you define a Jew? Well, shortly after Barry Goldwater won the Republican nomination for president in 1964, our friend Harry Golden quipped that it was only natural that the first Jew nominated for president was an Episcopalian. and then there was a fellow in Corpus Christi, Texas, that means body of Christ. So Sidney Wolf was the first Jew to serve on the park board in Corpus Christi. And he used to tell people the differences between different denominations. And he'd say, Jews do not recognize Jesus as the Messiah. Episcopalians do not recognize the Pope as an emissary of God. And Southern Baptists do not recognize one another when they go to a liquor store. Rabbi Levi Olin, one of my Jewish stars in Texas, and he was the second rabbi appointed to the University of Texas Board of Regents. And he recalled the time he was at a party in a huge mansion in Dallas, just like you saw in that TV show Dallas. Huge, huge mansion. And he's ready to leave, and he goes to open a door, and the hostess says, no, Rabbi, don't go that way. The swimming pool's out there. Don't go that way unless you can walk on water. And he says, one of my ancestors could. So the point of the story is that we're judged by our ancestors. Our ancestors really define us. You know, it was Barry Goldwater Jewish? Well, you know what? When the book, The Congressional Minion, was written, he wanted to be included. He told the author, please include me. That's my ancestry. So who is Jewish? And today, I'm looking at this from a national perspective, and I'm going to put a lot of what Richard and Robert were saying into a national perspective. In your folders, on one side, behind the schedule, there are two handouts. And I'd like you to pull them out. One is Southern Jews Elected to Congress, and one is Congressional Minion. And I'm going to be referring to these. Because, again, when Dale invited me to talk about Southern Jews in High Places, I couldn't find any one article that encompassed this topic. You have a judge here and a senator there, but it wasn't all put together. So I began reading general books and articles about Jews in Congress and Jews in politics, and called these lists. So what I found is that Supreme Court Justice Felix Frankfurter looked for a working definition of a Jew in politics, and he said, a Jew is a person whom non-Jews regard as a Jew. If you look at this list, there's a Mr. Cohen, there's a Mr. Levy, and they went to the Episcopal Church. Okay, so with names like that, but surely their ancestors were at Mount Sinai. So they are part of us, even if they don't want to be part of the community. Okay, so that's the yardstick by which, let's say, the Jew counters are looking to define us. Oh, you're a Levy, you're a Cohen, I don't care. I don't care if you go to the Catholic Church. You're Jewish, and we're going to count you as Jewish. But you know, they're not the only. It's not just the anti-Semites who are out there trying to count the Jews. We historians are doing it too. We're always looking to say, "Oh yeah, we were in the House, and we were in the Senate, and we were at the Alamo, and we're really proud that we were there." And so, when we look at what we call the Congressional Minion, by the most authoritative count, there have been 200 Jews have served in Congress between 1845 and 2012, and 26 were from the South. Now, even if a number of these people were what we call Jews without Judaism, we claim them all for the purposes today of members of the tribe. And then another question I began to think about is, why is it important for us to focus upon Jews in politics? Well, it brings us to the theme of my talk today, which is that politics serves as a reflection of Jews' civic integration and acceptance. And think about that as we go through the century. The first two Jews to serve in Congress were a guy named David Levy Yuli and Judah Benjamin. They're both Sephardic Jews. Neither of them affiliated. They intermarried. Their children were raised as non-Jews. And nonetheless, they were always pointed to as they're the Jew. They're the Jew senator. If someone disagreed with them, up comes an anti-Semitic remark. The third Jew to serve in Congress, he was born in Charleston. His name was Louis Levin. He moved to Pennsylvania, and he became a Protestant preacher. He was anti-Catholic. But him, too. The anti-Semites accused him of being a Jew, too. So we get everybody. So considering that politics is a reflection of our civic acceptance and integration, this shows you that it was really hard in the beginning of the United States of America to be a Jew in high places. And we heard before that it was relatively comfortable to be a Jew to be a Jewish office holder at the local level. And why is that? You know, I mean, in the colonial period, Jews fared very, very well in small towns. And why did they do so well at the local level? Well, first of all, there's this phenomenon we call philo-Semitism. Christians really like us. We're the people of the book. We're the ancestors of we're their ancestors. And so there's this initial amount of respect, especially when they know us one-on-one. And Jews came with a certain set of skills. For years, for centuries, living in the Pale of Settlement, Jews developed self-government skills. We have our charities and our cemeteries and a system of self-government, and the Jews in the diaspora transferred that. When they came to new communities that had nothing, here was the Jew. The Jewish merchant could read and write. I don't know about here in South Carolina, but in Texas, a lot of people were signing their names with an X. So here's somebody who's literate, can add numbers in their head. So the Jew was a natural candidate to run for high office, to place in high office, to run opposed. So in 1765, there were two Jews elected port officials in Savannah. And Robert and Richard already talked about Francis Salvatore, who was the first Jew to serve in a legislature ever. And they call him the Jewish Paul Revere, because he was also the first Jew to die in the American Revolution. So after American independence, there was a fellow, Jacob Henry, from, help me with my pronunciation, Beaufort, North Carolina. Is that right?
Yeah.
North Carolina's Beaufort, South Carolina's Beaufort.
Yeah.
Okay, that's a big lesson. So he was elected to the legislature in North Carolina, but you had to take an oath of office. Only Protestants were eligible for office, and they had to swear on the New Testament. Well, he was elected. So he made a very persuasive argument, quoting the New Testament all the time, showing that Judaism, there were lots of things in the New Testament that Judaism supported, and he should certainly be allowed to take his seat. And there was just, rancorous debate. And finally, his fellow lawmakers decided that he could take his seat without taking the oath, but he could never hold an appointed office in the state. So the oath would only apply to the appointed office. And that's in 1809, there were four other states that had oaths of office to choose. Okay, Connecticut, Massachusetts, Maryland, and New Hampshire had religious restrictions. And by the way, that religious restriction in North Carolina, it was modified in 1835. They changed the word Protestant to Christian. So Catholics could now take office, but I guess not. What were you saying? Heathens and Unitarians and Jews still couldn't. And finally, in Reconstruction, when the Constitution was completely rewritten in North Carolina, they took out that religious oath. Okay. Also, on the local level, as they told you before, you had lots of Jews serving as mayors in Georgetown and Richmond. Richmond had an acting Jewish mayor, Columbia. So then we move up to Congress. So in 1841, Florida was still a territory, and it was allowed to send a non-voting delegate to Congress. And they selected a fellow named David Levy. Okay. And who was David Levy? Well, I'll tell you a little more about him soon. Then Florida becomes a state, and in 1845, they were entitled to a senator. So David Levy was elected by the legislature to be their senator. At the same time, in 1846, David Levy marries a Presbyterian woman. And he adds something to his name. Instead of being David Levy, he becomes David Levy Yulee, Y-U-L-E-E. And where did he get this surname, Levy, Yulee, from? Well, his grandfather and his great-grandfather were very prominent in Morocco. They were advisors to the sultans in Morocco, and their last name was something like Ibn Ben Yulee. So he adapted that and added it to his name. So whereas before, when he was in Congress, John Quincy Adams, the former president, used to call David Levy the Jew delegate. When he changed his last name to Yulee, John Quincy Adams began calling him the alien Jew delegate, or the Jew with a dash of African blood. So even though David Yulee began to say that he wasn't Jewish, he didn't practice Judaism, and that he was of Moroccan heritage. That was his term. I'm of Moroccan heritage. It didn't matter. He's still the object of anti-Semitism. And he was pro-slavery. And when he would make it, every time he made a pro-slavery speech in the Senate, there was a Boston newspaper that criticized him. And they called him and other Jewish Southerners who were pro-slavery members of the accursed race. Now, also serving in the Senate was Judah Benjamin, who I'm sure you're well familiar with. And that Boston newspaper also had Judah Benjamin in mind when it criticized the Jewish lawmakers who championed slavery. Okay, Judah Benjamin, also of Sephardic descent, also with Charleston roots, by then is an attorney in Louisiana, is that correct? In Louisiana. And married Catholic, a woman who was a Catholic Creole from a prominent family. He was an orator on a par with Daniel Webster. And by golly, even though he didn't practice Judaism, if somebody aimed a bigoted attack at him, he answered. So when a senator from Ohio accused him, because he was pro-slavery, of being an Israelite with Egyptian principles, he said, "It is true that I am a Jew, and when my ancestors were receiving their Ten Commandments from the immediate hand of the deity, your ancestors were herding swine in Great Britain." So at the outbreak, so this is what we have. We have two Jews, high profile for anti-Semitism. And at the outbreak of the Civil War, 1861, both Yulee and Benjamin resigned their seats in the Senate. Jefferson Davis appointed Judah Benjamin to the cabinet. As you know, he was brilliant. He was the first Attorney General of the South, Secretary of War, Secretary of State. And a lot of people complimented Benjamin as the brains of the Confederacy. However, as we know, the South lost. His detractors blamed it on him. They called him Judas Benjamin and Jefferson Davis's pet Jew. So my observation here is that here you have prominent Jews in high places, but they become scapegoats. They're pilloried and they're ridiculed for their religious backgrounds. And it helps us understand why, in that period of American history, a lot of Jews stayed out of the national political arena. And it led me to another observation, is that in America, Jews have historically advanced through the arts, through education, entertainment, and certain retail businesses, clothing, salvage, jewelry, but not through politics. Yet the Italians and the Irish, they use politics to advance. Why didn't the Jews? Well, I'm not really sure. Maybe we didn't have sufficient numbers to create a political machine. Maybe it was because of centuries and centuries of hearing that the Jews killed Christ. Maybe it's because of being a lightning rod for anti-Semitism, throughout our history. We're the scapegoats for the plague. We're the scapegoats when a dead child turns up at Passover. Maybe that's why. That's what kept Jews from advancing that way. It was better to just, use your brains, use your family, start a store, create a chain of department stores, but don't hold yourself up there to be anti-Semitism. Now, after the Civil War, of course, you have a decline. You can see from your the sheet that there's not as many Jews in national government after the Civil War. But we do see Jews emerging as mayors. Okay. Again, we talked about on the local level, the Jews are doing well, their businesses are growing, and you have mayors after the Civil War in North Knoxville, Louisiana, Alexandria, Virginia, Paducah, Kentucky, Donaldsonville, Port Gibson, Mississippi has a fellow named Henry Bodenheimer in the 1880s. In Natchez, there's Mayor Isaac Lowenberg in the 1880s. Little towns like Shaw, Mississippi, Port Gibson, I said that before, Helena, Arkansas, and El Paso, getting to my state. This is great. In El Paso, the first Jewish mayor was elected in 1881. The second, in 1889, had to resign after 2 months because he was not yet an American citizen. Little thing. And then there's a wonderful Texas town called Schulenburg, and yes, there's a shul at Schulenburg. And they elected a fellow named Michael Levy for 3 terms as mayor in the 1880s. So we're seeing Jews are getting more and more involved in politics, but coming up through the local level. And then, toward the turn of the century, involvement peaks. And I found an interesting profile. Like, can you all hear me? I realized I didn't have the sign. Is this better? Is it on? Wow. Okay. Well, we'll keep that on then. Turn of the century, involvement is increasing. And I found a story in a book called Turn to the South. It's a wonderful book of essays that launched the Southern Jewish Historical Society. There's an essay in there by a Southern historian named Raymond Arsenal, and it's called Jewish Politician in the Land of the Razorbacks. I know we've been talking all about South Carolina, so it's time to be a little less parochial, people. And let's look at some of the other states. So Arsenal writes about a fellow named Charles Jacobson. He was, and he's an interesting profile. He starts out behind the scenes, he takes center stage, and then he disappears. First of all, he says that Southern Jews elected to public office at the local level from 1890 to 1915 was probably, the number was probably greater than at any time before World War II. Okay, so the list includes Adolf Meyer. He was a Confederate war hero from New Orleans. He served for 17 years in Congress. And there's a General Meyer Boulevard in New Orleans. So next time you'll know, that was one of our Confederate heroes. So there were more than a dozen state legislators, judges, scores of municipal officials, the mayors of Montgomery, Mobile, Pensacola, Shreveport were all Jewish. And we see, he says, careers carved out by Southern Jewish politicians stand as a testament to the fact that many turn-of-the-century Southerners had very tolerant attitudes toward Jews. Then he zeroes in on the career of Charles Jacobson. And Charles Jacobson was from Conway County, Arkansas. I mean, really backwoods. And a politician named Jeff Davis, no relation to the Jefferson Davis, was running for attorney general. And the folks in Conway did not like Jeff Davis. So he says to Charles Jacobson, who just graduated from Vanderbilt Law, will you be my campaign manager in your county for the primary? Because I can't even step foot in there, they hate me. So Charles Jacobson says, sure, I'll do it. And this fellow, this Jeff Davis, wins the primary in Conway, and he wins it so successfully that Jeff Davis says, I want you to be my campaign manager for the whole state. So we see Charles Jacobson is like the shadow behind the throne. And when Jeff Davis becomes attorney general, instead of going to the office every day and defending cases and acting like attorney general, he delegates all that to his Jewish friend, the young lawyer, Charles Jacobson. Because Jeff Davis is running for higher office, and he's going out hunting with people, he's raising money, he's making speeches, and he doesn't really have time to argue cases. And he runs for governor. Jeff Davis becomes governor of Arkansas from 1901 to 1907, and he names as his private secretary his good friend, Charles Jacobson. And Charles Jacobson becomes really the surrogate governor of Arkansas. He's deciding which bills to veto. He's like adjutant general of the state militia. He screens pardon requests. He makes patronage appointments. He's so powerful. Okay, but he even got in a fist fight to defend the governor at one point, so he's getting more and more recognition with his fist fights and whatnot. So when his boss and his mentor went up to the United States Congress, Jacobson decided he was finally going to throw his hat in the ring, and Jacobson runs for state senate. And he's elected overwhelmingly, and he's also very active in the Little Rock Jewish community, practically the assistant lay rabbi for Little Rock. High profile, he's a great lawyer, he's got a lot of personality. He runs for re-election, and he's overwhelmingly elected in 1912. Yet in 1914, he did not run for re-election. Why not? Well, what you had in the meantime was the Leo Frank case. Okay, it was in 1913 that Leo Frank was lynched by a mob. And as Richard and Robert were telling us, Leo Frank ran a pencil factory outside of Georgia, and a little girl named Mary Fagan was discovered mutilated and murdered. And who did they blame? Well, the last person who had seen her was Leo Frank when she'd come in to get her paycheck. So just hysteria, anti-Semitic hysteria was whipped up in a hurry against Leo Frank. And the Jews of Atlanta just shuddered. The hysteria was terrible. It was fanned by small newspapers. It was picked up. This marks the reemergence of the Ku Klux Klan across the South and the nation.
This is also a time when Eastern European Jewish immigrants are coming to the United States. And these Eastern European immigrants, they don't look like, what can I say? They don't look like David Levy. They don't look like Judah Benjamin. They didn't own plantations, no. They're coming in with their beards and their Yiddish accents. And they're lumped in the category of dirty foreigners who are taking away jobs from hardworking Southerners and hardworking Americans. And so it wasn't really that hard, apparently, to whip up all this anti-Semitism against Leo Frank. He was from New York anyway. Okay. Yeah. So what we see, what in this essay I'm telling you about Charles Jacobson, this historian, Ray Arsenal, argues really persuasively that Jacobson was driven from the political arena by a wave of anti-Semitism. Okay? And as the decade wore on into the 20s, the tensions are mounting. The anti-Semitism is mounting in the 1920s. You have Henry Ford, chief anti-Semite, printed 500,000 copies of something called The Protocols of Zion. This is a century-old accusation that there's a Jewish conspiracy to control the world. It's a forgery. It's a fake. But he distributed 500,000 copies of this throughout the United States, and people begin reading it. It's printed, right? If something's printed, that gives it a measure of credibility and validity. And that that was in 1920 and 22 that Ford goes on the rampage. And then there's a fella, wonderful priest named Father Koblen. Father Koblen is called the grandfather of hate radio. Yeah. And he took to the airwaves in 1926, preaching largely against us Jews. So all of this, beginning with the Leo Frank lynching, puts a real chill on the political process for Jews, especially in Atlanta and across the South. And if you look at the sheet on Southern Jews and politics, what do we say here? Southern Jews elected to Congress. Okay, 1907, we have this fellow Adolf Meyer, who's been in Congress for 17 years. He dies, and we don't see another Jew until, 1921 and 23, there's a fellow from West Virginia, Ben Rosenblum, from West Virginia, not the Deep South. This is South, not the Deep South. He's elected for two terms. And then there's nothing. Why aren't Jews running for high office? Okay. Well, so Arsenal makes that case. And I want to read you what he said. He says that in many southern states, the Jewish politician all but disappeared by 1916. Oh, there's exceptions. Texarkana reelected to the State House a fellow named Louis Joseph in 1914 for one term, and Pine Bluff elected a Jewish mayor named Simon Bloom in 1917, and both of them are gone by the end of the decade. Okay. Helena, Arkansas did elect one Jewish councilman in 1922, but not another Arkansas Jew was elected to public office until 1933. And that was the year that Saul Blatt was elected from Barnwell to the South Carolina legislature, and a fellow named Sam Levine went to the Senate from Pine Bluff. So we'll get back to that. Remember, 1933 is a critical year, and we'll get back to that. But that's a really long absence of Jews from the public stage. And what I was saying before, too, my theme as I was doing the research is that our Jewish political involvement reflects our civic integration and civic acceptance. And historically, Jews, we're really pretty insecure people. We don't want to, how many times does somebody run for office and they get phone calls saying, don't run, it'll be bad for the Jews, don't run, it's going to be anti-Semitic. You have politicians I've talked to say just as many people encourage them to run as discourage them from running. It's not good for the Jews. Keep your head down, do what you want to do. So before World War I, in the years before World War I, we don't see Jews in high-profile elective office, but what we do see is something called the emergence of the court Jew. I don't know if you've heard that phrase, the court Jew. So the court Jew goes back to a long time ago. Think of Queen Esther. She's a court Jew. She has the ear of the ruler, and when she's so moved, she intercedes to protect her people. And throughout history, it's interesting to look and see, are there some Jews that are very nicely placed next to the ruler? Okay? David Levy Yulee's grandparents and great-grandfather, they were court Jews. they usually people of money, people who are commercially savvy, who know how to, who can advise, who can loan money to the king, arrange loans. And there were Jews in high places who were in a position to do that. Sometimes, you know, things didn't work out off with their heads. It was a precarious position to be in. Think of the Rothschilds, court Jews, advisors to the rulers. So in America, we talk about the modern court Jew. Okay, think real hard who this might be. The modern court Jew would be someone with a lot of financial savvy, very wealthy, who becomes a financial advisor to the Oval Office. And in this era, 1916, as we're ready to enter World War I, the high-profile court Jew was Bernard Baruch. Yeah, Bernard Baruch. And who was Bernard Baruch? Bernard Baruch was from Camden, South Carolina. He was born in 1870. His dad was a physician and was in the medical corps during the Confederacy, serving with Robert E. Lee. His mom was D.A.R. and also a daughter of the Confederacy. However, when he was only 11, in 1881, his family moved to New York so he could get a good education. How prejudiced is that? And, but he maintained his ties to the South. He went to work on Wall Street as a clerk, and he became a Wall Street speculator. Before he knew it, he was like Donald Trump. He had so much money and such arrogance that everybody knew who Bernard Baruch was. But he maintained his ties to the South. When he became fabulously wealthy, he started buying up land in the South Carolina Lowcountry. He put together 11 old plantations, over 17,000 acres, and he called his estate Hopcon Barony. And I believe you've had a meeting there before. So that's who he was. And so as admirable as he was and what he did, his detractors thought there was something really sinister about his money. After all, he's a Jew, and he's greedy, and all Jews care about is money. So he was scorned for his money, and he was really revered for his success. In 1916, he left Wall Street to advise Woodrow Wilson. In 1918, he headed the War Industries Board and managed our mobilization during World War I. In 1919, he's named to the staff of the Paris Peace Conference. And when somebody complained to Woodrow Wilson that Bernard Baruch is vain, you know what Wilson said? He said, "What Jew isn't?"
Oh.
Yeah. Eleanor Roosevelt didn't like him either. She said he was crude and vulgar. And once she went to a party at his house, and after the party, Eleanor Roosevelt complained, "That Jew party was appalling. I never wish to hear money, jewels, and sables mentioned again." So to her and to many others, Bernard reinforces this stereotype of the Jew who's a greedy money grubber. How do you like that? And what did Jews think of him? Well, Jews were very ambivalent. You know, he marries a Christian woman, his children are raised as non-Jews in the church. He continued to go to the West End Synagogue in New York. And they say there were two reasons why he liked to go to synagogue on Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur. First of all, he would come fashionably late and cause a stir because everybody goes, "There's Bernard Baruch." And of course, Baruch means blessed, Baruch Atah Adonai. So the joke was he liked to go because he wanted to hear his name said. Okay? So he got this fellow with all this wealth and fame, but he couldn't escape anti-Semitism. Hey, even from us, it was said that some of his best friends were anti-Semites. Yeah, so we have this really ambivalent picture of this guy. And if he was asked to run for office or serve in the cabinet, but he wouldn't, because he knew that the anti-Semitism would really reach hysteria if he agreed to serve on the cabinet or if he ever tried to run for office. And when Roosevelt came into office, he was part of Roosevelt's brain trust. You know, along with some other prominent New York Jews. There was a Warburg in the brain trust, there was a Morgenthau, but Bernard Baruch was high profile. So FDR comes to power. Yeah, I guess that's the right word for FDR. FDR is elected in 1933. And interesting what happens, up until then, Jews had a hard time getting government jobs, even in the civil service, very hard time. Hard for Jews to get jobs in law firms. Well, FDR is elected, and the WASPs can't stand FDR, and the Protestant elite can't stand the Democrats, they can't stand FDR. And FDR has all these openings. There's thousands of openings in the civil service. So who does FDR begin appointing? Jews. Who was qualified? Lots and lots of educated Jews have come out of law schools, Jewish statisticians and lawyers and people with lots of skills. And so the New Deal starts to hire Jews. And I want to go back a minute. You had talked before about Saul Lott becoming elected to the South Carolina legislature and staying forever and becoming speaker. Saul Lott was from, correct me now, Barnwell County, South Carolina. Yeah, backwards. Is that right?
Yeah.
Sounded that way from what I read. Okay, so Saul Lott first ran for the legislature in 1931, and there were anti-Semitic whispers. He was so angry and disillusioned that he swore he would never run for public office again. Then 1933, and like I said, that is a watershed year. Roosevelt, the New Deal, the old deal has really been discredited. We're in the depths of the Depression, and they're looking for candidates who will run. And the party leader of Barnwell County asks Saul Lott, please run for office again. And he'd sworn it off, no way. Please run, I promise you, I won't speak against you this time, you're gonna run unopposed. So he runs. And again, so 1933, so we're seeing, let's say, a break. You've got this anti-Leo Frank chill extends to about 1933. The New Deal is encouraging bright young people, even if they're Jewish, to run for office. So 1933, found some very interesting statistics about Roosevelt. He appointed 254 Jews to high-level appointments, okay? And that's 15% of Roosevelt's appointments were Jewish. And that's not counting all the hundreds who got jobs just through the civil service. You've heard of the New Deal disparaged as the Jew Deal? Okay, well, the catchphrase New Deal was coined by a lawyer named Samuel Rosenman. Of course, he was Jewish. And he was a native of Houston, so we can also claim that the New Deal came from a son of the South. Okay, and among the Southerners who found a home in the New Deal was an attorney named Abe Fortas. Abe Fortas, born in Memphis in 1910, raised in a kosher home, went to a Presbyterian college, then he went to Yale. There's a lot of discrimination against Jews. And, you know, he was, what can I say, he was not an observant Jew, he didn't deny he was Jewish, but he was more what we might call today, maybe like a political Zionist, but not an observant Jew. He didn't even go to synagogue for the high holidays. So there's lots of wonderful Abe Fortas anecdotes. So Abe Fortas became chief counsel for the Public Works Administration. He had a staff of more than 1,000 employees, and he was committed to hiring only the most qualified. But the Public Works Administration had a perennial problem. They had too many Jews. Well, they were hiring the best. It was a meritocracy, and Abe Fortas wanted a little more balance. So he talks to his staff, you know, you've got to hire, it's just too many Jews. This looks like the Jewish mafia. This is just not right. So they search through all the applications, and finally they find one. They find a guy named Joseph Dunn. He's from Boston. He's got blue eyes and blonde hair. So this is a case of affirmative action. And they hired Joseph Dunn. They lowered their standards. He was at the bottom of his class at Harvard. Then comes Rosh Hashanah. And Joseph Dunn says, can I have time off for Rosh Hashanah? And that's when they learned that Joseph Dunn was Jewish. Well, when Lyndon Johnson became president, Cordes really, literally and figuratively, became the court Jew. LBJ appointed his friend, very close friend and crony, Abe Fortas, to be on the Supreme Court. And Fortas, while he's a brilliant, liberal lawyer, beautiful, wonderful opinion writer, he had a problem, though. There's something in American government called separation of powers. And he just couldn't stop being a power broker. He wrote LBJ's State of the Union address in 1966. He became friends with Teddy Kollek, the mayor of Jerusalem, and Teddy Kollek would smuggle him Cuban cigars in the diplomatic pouch. He became close friends with the Israeli ambassador, and the Israeli ambassador found it really convenient because he could send messages to the White House through Abe Forrest. Well, got in a little trouble for this because when Chief Justice Earl Warren announced that he was going to be retiring, Lyndon Johnson nominated Abe Fortas for Chief Justice of the Supreme Court. Wouldn't that have been something if the Chief Justice had been a Jew who was getting cigars from Jerusalem, whatever? It would have been so wonderful for us. But during the hearings about the Fortas nomination, it came out that he was conferring with Johnson all the time. What about separation of powers? So it got him in trouble. And of course, anti-Semitism came out. Senator Eastland from Mississippi starts whispering anti-Semitic things. And Nixon was president-elect. And we know Nixon had, ambivalent feelings about Jews. So a lot of anti-Semitic whispers come out. And a filibuster starts. And so the Fortas nomination is withdrawn. But that didn't stop the talk about his improper activity. He continued to be a power broker. And what came out in Life magazine, which Fortas liked to call Knife magazine, he had a very cozy relationship with another Southerner, a man named Lewis Wolfson. Lewis Wolfson was a corporate raider. He was from he grew up in Jacksonville. He played football at University of Georgia. And boy, did he make money, the original corporate raider with the hostile takeovers. Lewis Wolfson got in a little bit of trouble. He was indicted for, perjury and unreported stock transactions. And he had a relationship with Abe Fortas whereby he had agreed to pay Abe Fortas $20,000 a year for life. Essentially, as his, Abe Fortas was retained as counsel for life for Lewis Wolfson. Well, hey, a Supreme Court justice has no business doing that. Didn't need the money, shouldn't be peddling his influence. But when that came out, Abe Fortas resigned in disgrace. So sad. I could tell you Abe Fortas stories all afternoon. So maybe later in the bar we'll tell a few more Abe Fortas stories. So that got us ahead of the story, but if we go back to FDR, the end of World War II, Truman's in office, there's less anti-Semitism in politics, less anti-Semitism in high places, partly because all those Jews who came in the New Deal began to democratize the executive branch of government. The Holocaust softened attitudes toward Jews. And all those Jewish soldiers in World War II who fought for their country softened attitudes about Jews. There's a soft lessening of overt anti-Semitism. And the Jews are coming out from that invisibility that they had before the war. And they're beginning to build coalitions in politics with blacks, with unions. And a really good example of what's happening is someone named Mutt Evans. And I bet a lot of you have read the story. Mutt Evans is the father of Eli Evans, the author of The Provincials. And Mutt Evans, born in North Carolina in 1907 and raised in Durham. And when Mutt went to the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill in 1928, he wanted to get involved in campus politics. But in those days, it was unheard of for a Jewish student in 1928 to be elected to anything campus-wide at Chapel Hill. So he became the campaign manager for someone else who was running for office who became a future congressman. So as a merchant in Durham in 1950, Mutt Evans became part of a committee. It was called something like the Good Government Committee. They were looking for good candidates instead of corrupt candidates for public office. And at the last minute, right before the filing deadline, the mayor of Durham decided not to run for re-election. And the office came open. And everybody on the Good Government Committee said, the best candidate we can put up to run is Mutt Evans. He's a merchant with integrity. Everybody knows him. Everybody knows three generations of his family. And they persuaded Mutt Evans to throw his hat in the ring. Well, once he announced, who are his first phone calls from? Other Jews. They say, don't run, don't do this, you know? It's going to become really anti-Semitic. You're going to put us all on the firing line. Please don't run. His Jewish people were so afraid of being high profile. And sure enough, the campaign was very anti-Semitic. His opponents began distributing those Protocols of Zion about a Jewish conspiracy, emanating from Durham to control the world. Yeah. They call him a commie. They call him a Negro sympathizer. Obscene phone calls. One campaign picture showed his house. And Eli Evans writes how afraid he was that someone was going to bomb their house because it was on the front of a campaign brochure. And how did Mutt Evans answer all of this? He came out with posters that said, "Elect Mutt Evans, chairman of the North Carolina United Jewish Appeal, president of Bethel Synagogue," because he reasoned with a last name like Evans, maybe some people didn't know he was Jewish, and he wanted people to know front and center, I am Jewish, and he also knew that his neighbors were church-going people who respected someone else who was active in their religion. So he built a coalition. He built a coalition with the African Americans, with all of his customers, and he said that he could restore harmony to government. And there's an interesting concept here. He's running, there's not enough Jews to elect him, so he's building a coalition, and he's seen as someone who will represent everybody, because he's not representing one special interest. Some political scientists would say he's an in-betweener, or a go-between, the person who's going to truly try to represent each group, because he's not pushed into office from any one particular source. So on election day, his opponents handed out razor blades, okay, with the message that you should cut the Jew off the ticket. But it was said that the blacks lined up from here to Jerusalem to vote for Mutt. He won by 1,000 votes, 6,900 votes to 5,900, and he was reelected 6 times. So, a wonderful story about what is happening in American politics is the Jew, at different levels, is building a coalition, and being a little more open about who he is, who we are, and what we do, and what we represent. Now, if you look again at your sheet on Southern politicians, you see, again, in the 70s, suddenly there's a whole list of Jews, okay, where there's been this big absence. Let me see. Yeah, we've had this huge absence, since 1907, no Jews at the national level. In 1973, and since then, Jews from the South. And what is going on starting in 1973?
10 years after civil rights.
Okay, civil rights. There's, okay, my analysis is there's two things that are going on. You have the Voting Rights Act of 1965. Okay, thank you, LBJ. Voting Rights Act passed, 1965. And that meant, up until then, really, half of the electorate in the South was not registered to vote. Because you have literacy tests, you have the poll tax, lots of things are keeping people from registering. And then, you also have in the 60s something called One Man, One Vote. I don't know how many of you remember that. And that had to do with redistricting. People were not only disenfranchised because they couldn't read or write or couldn't pay the poll tax. The cases, let me see that. The first case is called Baker versus Carr, 1962, and it came out of Tennessee. The Tennessee legislature had not redistricted since 1901. So all those people elected to the Tennessee legislature were based on the census from 1901. So who's passing the laws in Tennessee and other places in the South? Someone who lives in a rural place who might represent 1,000 trees instead of 1,000 people. Another big decision is called Reynolds versus Sims in 1964. It came out of Alabama. In Alabama, some districts had 14 times the population of others. People from urban areas were not represented in the legislature. In the Supreme Court, the doctrine is listed in a couple ways, like one man, one vote. Today, we're gender neutral. We say one person, one vote. They also said that legislators represent people, not trees. They represent people, not acres, not farms, not ranches. So because of that, these decisions lead to redistricting, reapportionment, election of African Americans, women, Jews to the state legislatures. And this puts Jews in the pipeline to reach higher office. I want to give us an example. A woman who was climbing into government at that time, a woman from South Carolina named Harriet Kaiserling, who I think many of you know. Harriet entered the legislature in 1976. Now, how did someone like Harriet get elected? Okay? Harriet is a liberal Yankee woman, right? And she's living in Beaufort. Could she have gotten elected in 1960? No way. No. But by then, first of all, you also have the Sun Belt phenomenon. You have more city people are moving to Hilton Head and to the areas in her county. But they're also beginning to redistrict, and more people are able to register to vote. So Harriet enters the legislature along with other people. She found some allies. They called themselves the Crazy Caucus. And the Crazy Caucus were a bunch of freshman legislators like her who were, let's say, a bit more, they weren't your typical sellouts. What they found in the legislature was a South Carolina legislature bent on maintaining the status quo. The legislature was against integrating the public schools, and it passed repeatedly a law that attending public schools was no longer compulsory in South Carolina. And our friend Sal Blatt was a big segregationist. He and the others in the Senate in the legislature, they opposed home rule for local governments because it would have fragmented their power. And all this is coming from Harriet's book, which is called Against the Tide. Any time, let's say a school board in a rural county wanted to pass their budget, it had to go through the legislature. Power was really fractured and centered in the legislature, which could exercise a lot of control over what was going on out there in other places. So a major concern to Harriet was a nuclear waste dump in Barnwell County. And when she began asking questions about the nuclear waste dump, she went against Sal Blatt. Well, when she began to question the policies, he really didn't like it, and they never didn't matter that they were both Jewish. Those two never became friends. Let's just say there was a chill. Yeah. So Harriet became known as one of the legislators throughout the country with the most knowledge about nuclear waste dumps. And during her 16 years in the legislature, she became so knowledgeable. She and her coalition brought a lot of cultural, educational changes and advancements to the state. And I will say, is her son here?
Tomorrow, okay.
She stopped running for office in, I think, 1992. She said it just wasn't fun anymore. But her son did run and succeeded her. So we've got Harriet. She's in the legislature till 92. And you see on the timeline, lots and lots more Jews are getting elected to higher office. And then we have the seminal moment in American Jewish political history, and that is Lieberman. Lieberman is nominated to run for Vice President of the United States. Joseph Lieberman. Wow, Joseph Lieberman. Here's a man running for Vice President. His wife's name is Hadassah. His running mate is a Southern Baptist from a political dynasty. Okay? His Orthodox Judaism is spun as a positive. The Christians really liked him. Oh, he's observant. Yeah, he's among the chosen people. So being Shomrei Shabbos turned out to be a positive for him instead of a negative. It was admirable that this man doesn't vote on Shabbat. Okay? And I really believe he helped Gore get votes in Florida. You know, he was never blamed for Gore's loss in Florida. But for a few hanging chads, we would have had a Jewish vice president. So what this demonstrates is growing confidence and security among Jews. And although he was out front with his religion, we see that happening even before him. So again, back to my theme, if politics serves as a reflection of our civic integration and acceptance, by the year 2000, we Jews were fully integrated into the mainstream. Without disappearing or becoming assimilated, we were there in the mainstream. And more Jewish politicians were openly talking about their religion instead of hiding from it, like David Yulee and Judah Benjamin. Okay, here's some good examples. Florida's Debbie Wasserman Schultz, when she was sworn in, she didn't want to put her hand on the King James Bible. She wanted a Tanakh. So they start searching all over Capitol Hill for a Tanakh, and someone remembers that New York Congressman Gary Ackerman had a monthly Torah study in his office, and he had a Tanakh, so they use that. Okay. She introduced an act designating this month, May, as American Jewish History Month. Also in Florida, there was a congressman named Ron Klein. When he was in the legislature, he arranged for Miami to open a trade office with Tel Aviv. A front and center, no longer hiding. A fellow named, also from Florida. You know, Florida, some people say, is Florida really the South? Is it, some like to say it's the sixth borough of New York. And others say, when you go to South Florida, is the only place you have to go north to be in the South. But hey, it's really far below the Mason-Dixon line. Think about issues like gun control. They take that conservative stance on gun control. They're very slow to hop on the to embrace gay rights. So Florida is the South, even though we have a nice Jewish outpost in South Florida. And Eric Cantor is the majority leader, Republican. He's the only Jewish Republican in the House. They call him the chosen Republican. And Eric Cantor keeps kosher. And when the Richmond schools planned to open, have the first day of school on Rosh Hashanah one year, he and his wife lobbied to get it changed. So again, a high-profile Jew who's not hiding his Judaism, right up front and center with it. In Texas, there's a woman named a legislator named Ellen Cohen. And when asked about her responsibility as a legislator, she quotes Hillel. She says, "If I am not for myself, who will be for me? If I am only for myself, what am I? If not now, when?" Imagine saying that publicly, something that resonates with us. And in Florida, Congressman Peter Deutsch, when he described his responsibility as a lawmaker, he also cited Hillel. Hillel wrote that you should not separate yourself from your community. Yet those earliest Jews in Congress, Judah Benjamin, David Levy Yulee, they certainly separated themselves from the community. Remember, Yulee was so embarrassed by his Jewish roots, he used to stress his Moroccan heritage. But Lieberman and other Jews on today's political landscape, they embrace their Jewish identity. Jewish politicians today are openly Orthodox, they put mezuzahs on the doors of their office, they're openly kosher. And their openness as Jews really demonstrates that finally, at long last, Jews are fully civically integrated into the American mainstream. Thank you. Questions? Yes. And what's your name?
I'm Ralph Haller. How come there is no legislator from North Carolina listed here?
Can you name one?
No.
Has anyone from North Carolina or South Carolina gone to Congress? We talked before about who was it? Lee Atwater? Heller.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Heller.
Max Heller, where was he going to run from?
Greenville.
Greenville. So when he was running, anti-Semitism came out. Sad to say, right? Lee Atwater, talked about his Judaism, and that was the end of that candidacy. Very, very ugly. It is surprising because Charleston, South Carolina. Were really the seeds of Jewish politics, of American Jewish politics in America. Of the first six Jews elected to Congress, okay, we have four represented southern states. You had Louisiana, Florida, Alabama, I can't remember the other one. You had four representing southern states. Of the first six Jews in Congress, five had ties to the South, four had ties to Charleston, five of them intermarried, and two were anti-secession. So it's like, hey, so what happened? You know, it was very wonderful today to hear about the active involvement of Jews in politics throughout South Carolina. And I really don't know why none have gone through the pipeline like they have in other states and gone from the legislature, being state senators, to running for higher office. Yes?
What's the symbolism of a woman living in Texas wearing cowboy boots with Jewish scarves?
Oh, she's asking me about my boots. Here we go. Dale asked me to wear these. These are my Mug and David boots. And they're by Justin Boots made them. When I was editing the book a coffee table book about Jews in Texas called, we call it Lone Stars of David. I wanted a cover that, I want some conceptual art on the cover. So that when you looked at the cover, you would know, oh, this is a book about Jews in Texas, I want that. And so we came up with this idea of boots that have Jewish stars on them. Fort Worth, where I live, is the home of the Justin Booth factory. So we went and visited the vice president, Justin Boots, and he thought it would be great if there was a pair of Justin Boots on the cover of a book. And of course, you know, some of his best friends and clients are Jewish. This is like Fort Worth, it's like Charleston in that regard. Everybody knows who the rabbi is, and Jews are their friends. So we worked very closely to come up with this design. And the man, the bootmaker who worked the hardest on it was naturally named Jesus. And when it came out, so I had them make them in my size so that I could wear them. And they will never make another pair, but I'm really proud. On the front, there's two lions of Judah on the front, and there's the gold stars, and there's mug and donuts all over the place. Yeah. And Dale requested that I wear them today.
As she burns up in the heat in South Carolina.
Yeah, it got cool enough for me. You know, when we talked about the Leo Frank era, in Congress, okay, as a whole, there were fewer, no Jews elected from the South in those decades. But elsewhere in the country, Jews were elected. In the 20s, in that era, there were, let's just say, around the time of Leo Frank, when Leo Frank was lynched, there were an average of 7 Jews in Congress. By 1920s, there were 11 or 12 per session, but none from the South. So this chill, the way I see it, was throughout the South, not through the rest of the nation. Yes?
I'm thinking Brandeis was on the Supreme Court.
Yes.
And that was before Roosevelt?
Okay. No, let me see. The first Jew nominated was Brandeis was first in...
Woodrow Wilson, though.
Woodrow Wilson appointed Brandeis in 1916. So, yes, he would, again, another Southerner. Brandeis was nominated to the court in 1916. And then while he was still on the court, Felix Frankfurter. So there was no Jewish seat, but there were two Jews there at the time.
So while we weren't being elected, we were being chosen.
So while we weren't being elected, we were being chosen. Absolutely. I like that. I'll borrow that. Yes, Carl, yes.
You stated that Roosevelt hired many Jews for his administration.
Yes.
I'm a damn Yankee and old enough that maybe a lot of you don't remember, but Roosevelt was accused of being Jewish.
Roosevelt was accused of being Jewish?
Well, Roosevelt. There were signs in New York, "Do we know Jewy?" And Roosevelt, there were Rosenfeld.
Rosenfeld,
yes.
Oh.
Yes. So he was recruited.
So maybe we could say we have a Jewish president. I don't think so, but that's...
No, he was not, but what I'm saying is that...
People accused him, people intimated that Roosevelt was really Rosenfeld and of Jewish ancestry.
You know, Oscar Strauss was appointed as the first Jew to the cabinet. And I think that was 1916, Teddy Roosevelt. So that's not far from the Leo Frank thing. I just wonder about that.
Okay, I'll talk about Oscar... Okay, Strauss. Okay, when I'm talking about Southerners in Congress, I thought about Strauss. Okay, Strauss's. There's a family of immigrants. Strauss, they were in, help me out, Talbotton, Georgia. Did I say it right? Talbotton, Georgia. Okay, and Isidore went to Georgia Military Academy. He was in the Georgia Militia during the Confederacy. And, I guess he was too young to really go off into battle, but he became a blockade runner. And he got out, he went through the blockade with a shipload full of cotton, and he ended up, Isidore Strauss, he ends up in England selling cotton and selling Confederate bonds during the war. By the time the war was over, and he had amassed a lot of money and decided to come back to the States, his family had moved from Talbotton to New York. So he rejoins his family in New York, his younger brother Oscar, and they become the owners of Macy's, Abraham and Strauss. So I do you claim them as Southern Jews?
Why not?
Why not? If they're rich, we claim them.
Right. Okay. So Southern Jews. Okay. Oscar Strauss was elected to Congress, I think, Isidore was elected to Congress in the 1890s, and his brother Oscar was the first Jew on the cabinet around 1916. So yes, as you're saying, Jews were not so much, Southern Jews were not elected, but yes, if we claim him, they were chosen. He was on the cabinet.
Cardoza, he mentioned Cardoza.
I'm not sure what Cardoza was.
He was,
came
was
in
on
later.
The Supreme Court under Hoover, I think.
Under, I thought Roosevelt. Cardoza.
No, Hoover.
Somebody check on their iPhone when Cardoza was nominated to the Supreme Court.
Richard
Cardoza. Yeah, Belinda.
I have another question.
Sure, Belinda.
And your talk was fabulous. Thank you so much. But I was particularly interested with the way you finished up with this sort of new moment, if you will, where we see some incredibly different ways of expressing faith in public service. And we are in a new moment. I've been thinking, here in this state, we now have, as our governor, elected 2 years ago, the daughter of immigrants from India who was raised a Sikh. The whole national thing has changed so much, it's almost unbelievable. So what do you see happening? Do you foresee that we will have more Jews running for office, serving? I mean, what?
So Melinda's saying we're at a new moment where people are expressing faith in public service. Look at the governor of Louisiana. He's of Indian and Christian of Indian descent, and all this. And I will add that his the attorney general of Louisiana, Buddy Caldwell, is Jewish, and he's my son's father-in-law. So I wanted to get his Buddy Caldwell. Okay, and isn't that interesting? Yeah, we are seeing more openness. Well, let's see if America will elect a Mormon. When I hear this discussion of he's a Mormon, especially living in Texas, and people are wondering what's a Mormon. I think there's two sides of the coin. Maybe as always, like with Bernard Baruch, yes, he's the high profile Jew, but he's so greedy. And I think that you still have both sides of the coin: anti-Semitism, philo-Semitism. Oh, aren't we democratic? We have there's a Muslim in Congress, but we really don't trust them, do we? So I think that there's still a lot of ambivalence, Belinda, and I don't know what the future will hold. There's lots of, we hear lots of whispers and lots of prejudicial things. No, I don't think America is fully embracing, expressing faith in public service. And you hear, who was what's our president's middle name? Hussein? Well, why do they keep going back to that? But they do. The religious right does. And here, the religious right embraces the Jew because we're observant, and they want to make sure that there's an Israel just in case Armageddon happens next week. So I think there's dual motives for embracing diversity and for people mistrusting diversity. So it's wonderful that we're more open. Just wonderful that like Debbie Wasserman Schultz can put a mezuzah on her door, also be very liberal, or be recognized on the internet as one of the 10 legislators with the best tresses. She's got this curly, wiry blonde hair. But that's wonderful. But on the other hand, we really still have to be kind of careful. What's going to happen next, and where is the next anti-Semitic attack going to come from? But I think today we're bold enough to stand up to it the way Mont Evans did. More people are like that and are going to stand up to it. And that does remind me of some things. Like, you make inroads. Jimmy Carter appointed in 1972 the first Jewish judge to the Georgia Supreme Court, a fellow named Sol Clark. And Sol Clark was out of Savannah, Orthodox Jew. And Sol Clark made judicial history because he inserted the word chutzpah into a judicial opinion. And then in the in the footnote he put oy vey. And very interesting, since then, in like 1974, a number of courts have begun inserting the word chutzpah into opinions. And there's a wonderful article in the Kentucky Law Journal tracing this. Chutzpah gets into the Court of Claims, chutzpah gets into an Oregon court, chutzpah, and there's a chutzpah doctrine in some courts. And one wonderful, wonderful reading showing really how Yiddish, it becomes part of the American judicial jargon. It's not just on the Borscht Belt or on Dave Letterman, but Yiddish is being incorporated into the language and legal doctrine. And in 1998, there came a Supreme Court concurring decision with the word chutzpah. And who wrote that decision? Scalia, the Catholic. So anyway, back 19, Belinda, well, it surfaces as we're part of the whole, and so are minorities, but other times, yes.
I just wanted to mention that in between Brandeis and Frankfurter was Cardozo. He served for 6 years and was on the court, and he was succeeded by Frankfurter, thus came the so-called Jewish seat.
Okay, so Richard is talking about the Jews who served on the Supreme Court. So
and
first,
there was Brandeis, then Cardozo was nominated by Hoover.
Brandeis, Cardozo.
Then there was Frankfurter, and you know President Roosevelt was very reluctant. He didn't. You know, two Jews. They had been two Jews, but he was reluctant because of this Jewish Sikh thing. But you know, today there are three Jews and six Catholics on the U.S. Supreme Court.
Well, that also, okay, he was saying Brandeis is appointed by Wilson in 1916, Hoover appointed Cardoza, and then FDR appointed Frankfurter, although he was a little bit reluctant to because of the Jewish questions. And today there's three Jews?
Three out of nine.
Three, and how many Catholics?
Six.
Protestants. So we're not counting Jewish noses, and we're not counting Catholics anymore. But so what Belinda is saying is that there's more diversity, and yet it surfaces in different places, and it's good that we're not counting it. We're looking for the qualified. Hopefully, they're looking for the qualified people in the Supreme Court, but we just can't always count on that. So it's going to fluctuate. Yes.
You know, traditionally, we've heard that universities and colleges did admit Jews as undergraduates. But I've never heard whether the law schools were upfront in trying to break that down, or were they just as anti-Semitic and conservative, especially when you mentioned so many Jews became lawyers. Something was going on there.
He's asking, were there quotas in colleges regarding Jewish students and law schools? Yes, there were. It was hardest, let's say, on professors. Very difficult for Harvard and Yale were among the last to appoint Jewish professors. They did apparently have Jewish quotas, and there were lots of people like lobbying to get Fortas into Yale Law. They knew he was bright. He'd gone to Presbyterian College, and people from Memphis inserted their weight to get Fortas into Yale. And so were there quotas? Okay, yes and no. They were accepting the best. But there was discrimination once they got there. Fortas has a roommate, but the Protestant fellows in law school were discouraged to find other quarters if they were paired with a Jewish person. He couldn't get into the various eating clubs. The Jews did get on the law review. So something had to do with merit. We find the Jews moving into that, but if it was social, they didn't. So it was a difficult kind of game for the Jews who went to the law schools. Yes, a lot of Jews went to law schools, but it wasn't so much, let's say, the private law schools. You've got a lot of Jews going to law schools in New York City. My father-in-law went to Fordham Law, Catholic school. Was happy to have a Jewish boy in there. It had to do with affording it, too. So we see lots of Jews going to city law schools so they could live and work at home and go to those schools. And then they come into the New Deal with their law degrees. Does that answer that?
Yes, thank you.
Okay. Yes?
Statistics. A little over 50 years ago, my college roommate asked Dean Griswold at a tea at Harvard Law School whether they had a quota on Jewish students. He said, yes, they did. Nothing under 65%.
The quota for Jews in law school is 65%. You know, and today they schools, graduate schools are just concerned that they have too many Asians. Yeah, they can't pronounce their names.
Medical schools too in the 1930s.
Medical schools in the 1930s. They say the Asians are the new Jews. Making their way in, and maybe that's part of the story of America is one minority group after another pushing to break down the barriers. Yes, sir.
Just a present note, my daughter is running for a judgeship in Mecklenburg County, which for some reason is an elected position, and on her website she states that she is on the board of trustees of the synagogue and all this sort of stuff, so she's announcing her Jewishness on her website, TrumpJudge.com.
Okay. Running openly as a Jew judge in Mecklenburg County. Yes, Mecklenburg.
If you do look up the website, you got to put the www in front of it. It won't get you there. So, TRAW, TrawForJudge.com.
And I believe, correct me if I'm wrong, but Mecklenburg County is named for a Jewish family. Mecklenburg. Yeah. My rabbi is Ralph Mecklenburger. He said his antecedents are from there.
I just want to ask you one question. Do you think the 67 war, when Israel all of a sudden becomes very popular and American Jews now are very proud about being Jews, do you think that had anything to do with any of this? I mean, it's, I agree with you.
I think the 65
Voting Rights Act definitely had a lot to do with it, but I'd be curious about these districts because, you know, I'm just curious about that, you know, that there was a big sea change in among American Jews and in the American public.
Mm-hmm.
Because the Jews all seem very proud about being Jews and stuff like that. Do you have any thoughts about that?
That's a good point. Robert is saying that something else was happening in the 60s along with the Voting Rights Act and one person, one vote is the 1967 war. Yes, after the 67 war, Jews were seen as fighters. The South was really rooting for the Jews against the Egyptians. It was wonderful. Again, there was a lot more openness about Israel and Jews after the 67 war. And so I would say, yes, I think that might figure into the equation, too, of acceptance and Jews being more open about it. That would be when my husband was in Virginia military, and he said, yes, he was called Heeb. BMI had a minion, and so if one guy was out of town on an athletic trip, they didn't have to have Friday night services. So that's how it was at BMI. So he said, yes, after the 67 war, people began asking him more questions about the Israelis and Israel politics and about Judaism. And so, yes, there was more, people were more apt to talk about it and to ask and to be glad, this. Oh, you're the only Jew I ever met. I'm from wherever, and I understand you're Jewish. Tell me about this. So there was more openness, definitely. An Abe Fortas story about the 67 war is that Abe Fortas was conferring with Abba Eban and Ambassador Harmon, and he let them know the United States. Here's tension mounting with Egypt and Israel, and Johnson's not going to do anything about it. And if you decide to do something, Johnson's going to back you. And so the story is, according to his biographer, that the Israelis knew that America wasn't going to do anything, wasn't going to get in their way of attacking, and that helped precipitate the Six-Day War and the attack on Egypt. Yeah, so we had a lot to do with that. Southern Jew. Okay, well, I want to thank you. It's so much fun to be here. Always fun to come to Charleston. Thank you very much for the invitation.
Thank you. We enjoyed that very much. Excellent.